Haiti was I born as a slave. More than 150 years in the past, with a power I do not fully understand. I am known as Jean-Pierre Desperrois, and Destiny, she calls my name. Chapter 3, La Morgue. The apartment of Gatete is a small room. A cot with a tin mattress with no sheets and many stains sits against one wall. A desk and a chair occupy a corner. There are no light bulbs or switches or outlets for the electricity, but a lamp for kerosene sits on the desk along with a sheaf of paper, a pen, and a bottle of ink. This would suggest that the man can read and write. I wish I knew this when he worked for me. But it is no matter now, eh? A small dresser, presumably holding the shirt and stockings of this man, if he ever wears them anymore, is the only other furniture. Gatete keeps the gun pointed at me, and he sits on the floor.
Sit,
he says. I sit on the floor across from him. He keeps his gun pointed at me.
Open the bottle.
I do.
Drink.
I take a sip from the bottle. He frowns.
I said drink.
I take a big swallow. I am not one to drink in the morning, and I do not look forward to the effects if this man forces me to drink more. But his face opens up in a big smile. He laughs a big laugh of much heartiness.
Just in case it was gasoline,
he says. Then he grabs the bottle from me and gulps back a large gulp, perhaps a quarter of the bottle in one long pull. He wipes his mouth with the back of his huge hand. He sets the gun on the floor between us and the bottle next to it.
Jean-Pierre, old friend, what can I do for you this fine morning?
Finish your breakfast, please. He takes three more of these large gulps from the bottle. Tell me, who is Pierre-Georges Picot?
Who?
Pierre-Georges Picot.
I do not know this man.
He visited me last night. He says he lives in Calouche Town.
Never heard of him.
But you know many people who live here, no?
I know most of the people who live here, but not everyone. I do not know this Georges Picot.
I say nothing.
Georges Picot, that is a strange name for this place,
he says.
Most of the people who live here have African surnames, not French.
This is true. So, Pierre Georges Picot is a liar. This is no surprise. It makes me to wonder whether this man will come to me once he is paid. But I have another question for Gatete. Who is Macandal? I say. He looks puzzled.
Who?
He says. Now I remember why I fired him. He gives himself away too easily. He is not covering up now, either. And never mind, I say, standing up. If you hear anything about a Georges Picot or a Macandal, will you send word at Marat's?
I will.
I know he will not. My problems are not his problems. He stands up. He holds out the bottle to me. It is about three-quarter empty. Keep it, I say, for lunch. I turn to go, and there is a loud noise of someone yelling. It is coming through the window from the street below. Gatete and I move to his window and look down. A French gendarme is beating on a black man while a black woman tries to stop him, and a small black child clings to her skirt. The slop on the street, it splashes around them. They seem to pay no attention to the slop. The gendarme is yelling at the man, trying to get information from him. The man is saying something, or he tries. I have a hard time understanding because his voice is panicked. And the woman and the child, they are also screaming. The cop has his club in his hand. He pulls his arm back to beat on them. The woman grabs his arm, but she is too weak to stop him, and he hits the man. Once, twice, a third time. The man cannot now stand on his own, is bleeding heavily from the head. The woman and child scream. The woman grabs at the cup, her fingernails ripped the color of his shirt, surprising her and the cup. This is when I noticed that the color of his shirt, it wears it very high, as if it is a color from another century. As he turns toward her, I see a large purple burnt mark above his left eyebrow. Very disturbing, very distinctive. Losing her balance, the woman trips back over the child, falling just as the cop swings his billy club at her. The club and his hand, they hit the wall, hard. A piece of stucco, it splashes onto the street. If it had been a red, it would have exploded like a cantaloupe. There are good cops, and there are bad cops. If I had any doubt before, I know now that this cop, he is one of the bad cops, no? With no answers to my questions in Kalush Town, there is no reason to stay here. The stink alone is reason to leave. Another is the fact that I do not want this bad cop to see me and to make me his next victim, no? This cop, he continues to do his work on the street. I say goodbye to Gatete, who's already consumed the rest of the contents of the bottle. So much for lunch, no? I walk down the stairs, find the back door to the building, and make my way through the narrow alleys out of here. Later today, perhaps I will buy a new pair of shoes, no? There is one other person that I know who may know something of this, Makandar. She gathers up information the way a spider gathers flies. If anyone in Tunis will have some answers, she will. Picture, if you will, a city under a city. A labyrinth of streets upon which the sun never fully shines. Over each street, an arched roof in which there are small square openings to the sky every 10 or 15 feet, and they provide the only light. These skylights leave shadows on either side of the street, and in these shadows sit alcove after alcove. In each of these alcoves, there sits a little shop. One for the spices, another for the sweet meats, another for the bread, another for the tin lamps, you understand, huh? In the street at peak hours, a man can barely move for the crowd. Men in turbans and fezes, women in western blouses and skirts and eastern veils and burqa, children on foot and in prams. Men and women from Turkey and Algeria, Arabia and Rhodesia, and France and England. But I am still early. Most of the alcoves are abandoned at this time, but the one I am looking for, it is open. It is always open. This shop, it is quite different from the ones around it. The other shops, they are decorated with bright color. Their wares are well displayed. To attract customers, I'm sure. But this shop has no bright color. Its wares are not well displayed. They are practically to be hidden. Some unmarked packets of brown paper sit on a counter. To look at them, they would appear to have no value. A dull printed cotton curtain hangs as a backdrop, as if not to attract attention at all. If I did not know what was so dear, I would be surprised that this shop stayed in business. A woman in a black chador sits behind the counter. Her eyes are her most noticeable feature, a shocking turquoise against her black lashes, brown skin, and the surroundings of her shop. They see me, but they do not react to my approach.
"May I help you, monsieur?"
she says. Her voice has a certain smokiness to it. "A word in private, please," I say. Gada Buchlaka, for that is the name of this woman, looks around to see if anyone is looking her way. The souk is deserted. She motions me to behind the curtain. If I had not been here before, it would surprise me that behind the curtain was another alcove, much more large than the one out front. A single electric light bulb in the ceiling illuminates an office, complete with desk and two chairs for guests. The desk, it is quite large and made out of wood. It is perhaps the kind of desk a captain of the pirates might have on his ship, no? On the desk, there sits a blotter, some paper and a pen, a newspaper. Against the wall, a screen, a mirror, a large bucket. Next to those, a bookshelf packed with their wares. Brick upon brick of densely pressed hashish. No wonder the shop it is not closed, eh? As long as there are no Frenchmen caught with the wares so dear, the gendarmes, they will look another way. Perhaps it is that they prefer to have the local population a little stunned, eh? Easier for them to control, no? Whatever is the reason, Gada, she makes out well in our business. The curtain, it falls behind us, shutting us off from the souk. As I look toward my hostess, there is a blur of motion, and before I can duck out of the way, my cheek, it is stinging. She shakes out her hand, her eyes betray her anger, she points a finger in my face.
How dare you come back here, Jean-Pierre?
Ah, that, I say.
Yes, that.
She is already removing the headdress and veil from her head.
Did you think when I woke up, I would conveniently forget that when I went to sleep that night, you were in my bed? Did you think I would think that was a dream?
I have always liked Gada. She has, how you say, a personality. She also has a selective memory. After all, she did the same thing to me the night before, but I know her well enough to know that with her, the branches of argument, they will bear no fruit. Look, I say, it was a busy time. I could not stay.
Nor could you call, I see.
She shakes out her auburn hair, which falls past her shoulders. She throws the black cloth that had covered it onto her desk. As I said, it has been a busy time.
Original.
I did not think you would think anything of it.
You were wrong.
I see.
And?
Her eyes flare with a turquoise fire. I bow my head. I am terribly sorry, I say. There is an uncomfortable silence. The memory of that night, it comes back to me. I cannot help but smile. But it was good, no? Her face does not suggest that she, in fact, thought it was good. Gada, she sits at her desk. She does not offer me a chair, but I sit in one anyway. She spits into a copper urn on the floor. It makes the sound of a bell.
Why are you here, Jean-Pierre? Tell me, then go.
A man gave me a message last night from another man who calls himself Macandal. Have you heard this name before?
No.
She leans back in her chair, puts her feet on the desk. She is wearing black boots. The soles are worn in.
Should I have?
I do not know. But you often hear of things that others do not hear for a long time after, no?
I'm just a good listener.
There were rumors of this man, Macandal, coming from Kalush town, but this morning I went there and my contact had never heard the name.
Perhaps he wasn't from Kalush town.
Oh, you are a very clever one, Gada. Very clever.
So I've heard.
But you've heard nothing of this Macandal?
Nothing, Jean-Pierre.
What about a man who calls himself Pierre-Georges Picot? She thinks for a moment.
No, never heard that name either.
This news is not good. If Gadai has not heard of these men, then this Macandal is very good at hiding, no?
Maybe that will be the last you hear of Macandal, then.
I do not think so. He had a man come to wreck my apartment, this Georges Picot. There is a message, one that tells me the name Macandal, to fear the name Macandal.
And do you?
I do not fear much.
That doesn't answer my question.
I've told you the reason why I am here. I go now. I stand. She speaks.
And what are your plans Friday night, monsieur?
No plans.
Perhaps I will see you then.
It can be arranged, I say. Despite my best efforts not to smile, I find myself to smile. I turn to leave and I notice a large headline on the front page of the newspaper on her desk. The headline reads, L'homme assassiné est découvert. C'en était Gauger. A man found murdered. Throat slit. I take the paper, not even thinking to ask. I look closely at the photo. The dead man bears a strong resemblance to the man who visited me last night. I read, a black African man of unknown origin was found dead last night, his throat slit from ear to ear. Police have no clues. Gendarme says there was a surprisingly small amount of blood at this scene. A small amount of blood. This story has the feel of déjà vu, no? I scanned the article to discover where his body was found, but of course, Rue de Lambert, my street. Gada says,
is everything okay?
Her voice betrays her concern, but I do not bother to reply. I toss the paper back on her desk. She can read it for herself. I go back through the curtain to the front of her shop, leaving her sitting at her desk. The souk, now it is alive with people. The salesgirl who works for Gada now stands behind the counter, dressed in white robes and a veil. She sells two packets to a man as I leave. The chador, the robes, the veils, they serve to attract a certain kind of customer, no? It is no surprise that those who shop at this shop are mostly men. They hope with every purchase that they will get a peek behind a secret something, huh? Gada, she is quite a woman. The small part of me that is not concerned with Macandal and his messenger is looking forward to Friday night. It is located on the outskirts of the old city. It is a walk from the Medina of perhaps 15 minutes. As I walk, two voices, they debate in my mind if I should go at all. It is not the usual habit of mine to walk directly into an office of the police. In fact, I have never done this, neither by my own choice nor by the choice of any gendarme against my choice. I imagine I am lucky that way, no? But perhaps it is not luck at all, for I do work with the local police, or should I say some work for me. Dupri is an example that is perfect, but I prefer to meet them at my office, not at their office, no? My table at the Tavern of Marat. I do not want my face to be known by those to whom I do not wish it to be known. So I choose the place and the time for to meet. And at the tavern, both the place and the time of my choosing allow me to disappear with much quickness. But the picture of the dead man in the newspaper did not have enough clearness for me to be certain of the identity of that dead man, and I need to be certain. Besides, I have never been to the morgue myself before. The police who work there are not the police who work the streets. They will not recognize me there, and I have already come up with a reason to be there, which is also a reason for that they will let me inside. I cross the street toward a wooden cart, loaded up with the vegetables. The man who is selling them, he looks toward me. The man, he looks bored. I pick up the onion that is the most small from the cart. How much? I say. He holds up two finger. 2 centimes. It is too much, but I'm in a bit of a hurry, so I do not argue with him. I hand him the coins, then pull out my kubasa. The man at the cart, he pulls back from me a little, but the knife, it is not for him. I cut the onion into 2 pieces. Clean the oil off of my knife, put the knife away, then take 1/2 of the onion in each of my hands and rub them into my eyes, I cannot say it does not hurt. De vegetable merchant, he does not look any longer quite so filled with boredom. I hand him an extra centime to keep his mouth shut from speaking of this later. With tears streaming down my face, I walk around the corner to the morgue and straight up to the guard.
Bonjour, monsieur,
I say.
I've read in the papers today that there was a man murdered last night on the Rue de Lambert. The picture in the newspaper, it looks just like my brother. He has no telephone, and when I went to his apartment just now, he was not at home. I am filled with worry. Will you please allow me to look at the body?
It is hard to open my eyes at all. I imagine that there must be a redness around them. It feels like there is a redness around them. The rubbing of onions into the eyes, it is very, very painful, no? My state of distress causes the guard not to bother to ask me any questions. He looks at me with sadness and with sympathy, then opens the door. It is already beginning to get hot outside, but inside this building, the heat, it is so bad it causes difficulty to breathe. Causing the difficulty of breathing also is the smell. The smell that is a mixture of sweat and rotting flesh, and that chemical to pickle the rotting flesh, formaldehyde. The building, it once served for another purpose, as can be seen by the stone carvings of much ornateness around the doorways and the tiles of marble on the floor, but that other purpose has been forgotten for a long time since the arrival of the French. And now this place, it will live out its days as a home for the dead until someone knocks it down and its purpose is lost forever. I look from door to try to determine where they keep the bodies. A man in a lab coat with stains of reddish-brown on it appears from one of the doorways.
Can I help you?
He says. The tears have not stopped their flowing, and so I tell him about my poor, poor brother. He asks me to follow him through a different door than the one from which he has emerged, and now we enter a room just as you might imagine, with a wall of drawers designed each to hold the body of a dead man. The smell that I smelled when I entered this place, it is even more strong in this room. The doctor, he leads me to one of the drawers, and with a hard pull, two black feet emerge, with a tag on one of the toes, then a white sheet over the rest of the body. When he pulls back the sheet from the head, my suspicion, they are confirmed. The gash on the throat of the man runs across his neck from one ear to the other. This man who lies murdered before me now was only last night sent to my apartment to wreck it and to get my attention. Now that I look at the dead body, I realize that it was no accident I found him in my apartment. Perhaps it was the intention of Macandal for me to kill him, but when I did not, Macandal, he had the man to be killed himself, no? The dead man before me here was paid in advance in gold. He hid the gold and now he is dead. This means that Macandal does not care whether he loses the gold forever. What kind of a man does not care about losing gold? Who slit the throat of this man before me here? Macandal himself? Or another man paid in gold by Macandal? Perhaps also even the killer of this man does not know Macandal? Why would a man pay a man to kill a man to get my attention? Are there not better ways to get the attention of a man than to pay people to kill other people? Why would this Macandal or any man want to get my attention at all, unless it is to purchase the salt? I would not now sell salt to this Macandal anyway. I do not sell salt to murderer. But then, for what does he want my attention? The coroner, he says, is this your brother? I nod. My body, it is shaking. This is not part of my charade. I'm so angry that my body shakes. I must find this Machendahl. Whatever is his purpose, if only to stop him from killing more innocent men. The coroner, he looks down again at the body and he frowns. The real mystery is what happened to all his blood. His body was drained of it, but there is none to be found at the scene. He looks from the body to me. I'm sorry, he says. That was inappropriate. I shake my head and cover my face in my hands, heaving my shoulders a little. I do this because, first, I do not want this man to remember my face, and second, because the effect of the onions is starting to wear off, and I do not want him to see that my eyes are no longer filled with the tears. The man, he tells me that they need the body for their investigation, but that I can arrange for the proper burial of the body in 2 days. He tells me to go to the desk at the front and ask for some paperwork or another. I nod my head, with my hands still covering my face. I turn to go. As I begin to leave, the man says, I don't mean to be rude, but some mint, perhaps. I look at him. My tears have finally dried, but the man, he takes me by surprise. For your breath, he says, with a look of sympathy on his face. Onions. Dupree. He knew of the dead bodies in the desert. Surely he must know something of the matter of this dead body in the morgue. If not, perhaps he knows someone who does know. The coroner. He told me that they needed the body of the murdered man for their investigation. This means that there is, in fact, an investigation. So there must be someone in the police department who has some answers, no? If ever there was a reason to pay Dupree, this is it. My head is filled with thoughts of much ugliness and confusion as I attempt to sort through the few clues at my disposal. I exit La Morgue and walk fast toward a public telephone that waits for me across the street to place a call to Dupree. I am focused on nothing else but getting some answers, but before I can even get across the street, a hand grabs my shoulder. It is the hand of a gendarme.
Monsieur,
he says,
come with me.
Get your hands off me, I say. I look at him. It would be nothing at this moment to crush this man. He is a small man. But the consequences later, they would be something, no? I control myself.
You're under arrest, sir,
he says.
For what? I've done nothing wrong.
For the murders of 3 unidentified black Africans.
2 other gendarmes join him as a police car pulls up on the street next to us. There is nowhere for me to run, so I must go with them with willingness. I can only hope this interview will be to be over with some quickness.
Into the car, please, monsieur.
They do not give me time to get in of my own accord. But instead, they grab me and force me into the car as one of them pushes metal cuffs against my wrist. My head, because I am taller than them, it's the opening of the door. I stumble backward. A bad mistake, no? There is nothing I can do when the other one pulls out his stick and hits me across the back of the head. There is a flash of redness. Then nothing but darkness.
You've been listening to Salt, The Lives and Times of Jean-Pierre Desperoir. I'm Jason Newlander, and I wrote and narrated the story. Buzz Moran and Julie Lenard provided additional voices. Buzz also produced this recording. Music by Adrian Quesada. There's more to Jean-Pierre Desperoir at theintergalacticnemesis.com. Salt is part of the One of Us Podcast Network.